It's a pleasure to be here, and it's an honor to be giving the Sigma Psi lecture. This is actually my first Sigma Psi lecture ever. I have a 2-year gig coming up with this thing, so yeah, so you guys are the first ones. This is not the first time I've given this talk, however, so hopefully it won't be unrehearsed. Okay, so I've had the pleasure of interacting with a large number of researchers and law enforcement agencies in California over the last 7 years studying crime. And so my talk is going to go over sort of a series of vignettes of different models that we've worked with for different types of crime problems. A lot of this coming from Los Angeles, although the ideas are somewhat universal. You may be wondering, what is this crazy picture that you're looking at for the last few minutes while you're sitting in your chairs? This is actually simulated burglaries. It's not real data. It's simulated data based on the patterns that we see in the real data in an area in the San Fernando Valley that's about 18 kilometers across. This is the San Fernando Valley. And what you're looking at are the locations of the simulated crimes and what we believe the sort of hotspot attractiveness field associated with those crimes might be in the San Fernando Valley over the course of about a year. You might think that's a whole lot of crimes, but this is 18 kilometers across, so it's a fairly large geographic area. And one of the things that's been very excited about working with the police in Los Angeles is that in terms of being a test bed for doing scientific study, we have a city with incredibly large geographic extent and also a very large population. It's one of the few cities in the U.S. where one could do a study of this scope. As scientific researchers, I'll tell you the story how it started. So this is getting to the punchline, but I'll tell you, this guy here, Jeff Brantingham, came to me about 8 years ago. He's an anthropologist at UCLA, and I'd never worked with anyone in the social sciences. So just to get an idea, how many of you in the audience are mathematicians? Okay, and then do we have some biologists here? Do we have physicists? Chemists? Do we have any social scientists in the audience? Okay, we have a few. Great. Okay. So prior to working with social scientists, I had pretty much worked with people in various connections to physics. The joke I like to tell people is when I was at Duke University, I worked with some environmental scientists. We had a student working on modeling sap flow in trees in the Duke Forest. And so when I got to UCLA, I thought, there's no trees here. What am I going to do? What am I going to study? And there it is, right? So Jeff came to me, a social scientist, came to me and said, I really want to work on crime with mathematicians. I need your help. I have connections with the police. And, you know, I was kind of skeptical, a little bit snobby. I'm like, a social scientist? So I said to him, I looked at him sort of over the top of my glasses like this, and I said, so tell me what kind of data you have. And he said, well, here's an example. We have data from all the automobile thefts in LA last year, 48,000 of them. We have make, model, and year of the car. We have the GIS location of where the car was stolen from. We have the date and time. We have the GIS location of where it was found, if it was indeed found. And I thought, okay. That's data. So that was the first check mark, right? Then I said, okay, Jeff, we need money, we need problems, we need data, and all of those things suddenly appeared. And so we started working on this project. And so as of 2011, and this is very, very rare in math, by the way, when NSF tries to justify basic research funding to Congress, they say, yeah, you're gonna fund this thing, and maybe 20 years from now, it might make it into everyone else's lives. Like, take the internet, for example, right? That's the classic example. I was using the baby version of the internet, which we called the ARPANET back in the 1970s. I was using that as a kid because I had some connections that got me an account. And, it wasn't until the 1990s that the internet went commercial in the early 1990s. I remember that, too. So the fact that we could take, basic research that was just published and within 2 years have a commercial company that's now running software in close to 50 cities worldwide is pretty amazing. So this is probably the biggest success of our program, which is now a company called PredPol. It started with a little experiment in 2011 in Santa Cruz, where Santa Cruz PD said, hey, we want to try this thing you guys are doing at UCLA. And they were doing nothing at the time, I mean, other than just sort of common sense patrolling. And so they started using the software and had a 27% reduction in crime within the first month. We thought, okay, maybe this is actually useful for something. So I decided to keep you guys awake in the beginning of the talk. So we ended up getting some press about this. So NBC actually, you know, one of the beautiful things about being in LA is that there's a lot of people in the movie industry. So if you actually want to make a film, there are a lot of people you can hire right there. So NBC showed up in Los Angeles and said, we want to do a short clip about your work. So I'm going to play that clip for you guys. And then you can maybe get comfortable in your seats because it'll get more technical, the talk. Okay, so we're going to toggle to my video here. Let me just toggle to this and play the... It's about 4 minutes, I think.
A major winter storm.
One of the bruising fight to win Tuesday's Republican most dangerous virus possible.
Los Angeles, California, second most populous city in the United States, spread out over 468 square miles. With nearly 4 million residents and fewer than 10,000 police officers sworn to protect and serve, keeping order is a full-time job.
We are playing probabilities and putting officers in the right place at the right time.
To make the most of their resources, police captains like Sean Malinowski of the LAPD and other police departments across the country are turning to a new tactic to help stop crime before it happens. It's called predictive policing.
It calculates for the next 12 hours in the future what areas have the highest probability of a crime occurring. And then what we do is we provide that information to the officers, and then the officers go out and they try to prevent those crimes from occurring.
The predictive policing program used by the LAPD didn't come out of a police academy. It's based on research by a team of mathematicians and social scientists at UCLA, trying to predict where and when crime is most likely to happen.
I'd had these ideas that really human behavior is actually really quite predictable, and that you can study human behavior and understand where crime patterns come from in a very quantitative way.
With funding from the National Science Foundation, anthropology professor Jeff Brantingham teamed up with mathematics professor Andrea Bertozzi and others to analyze crime patterns and develop computer models to simulate criminal behavior. Their crime prediction model is based on the same algorithms used to predict earthquakes and aftershocks.
Once an event happens, it triggers another event. And so you can apply this idea to gang crimes, you can apply it to burglaries, you can apply it to automobile theft. There are many types of activities for which this idea is very relevant.
Thousands of pieces of crime data from the LAPD, including locations, times, and dates of past crimes, are processed by the software program known as PredPol to calculate and predict the potential criminal activity for an area at a certain time.
And those predictions are delivered back to the police departments in a way that allows them to use it in a real-time fashion.
So I'm going to code 100 in the area.
At roll call in the Foothill area of Los Angeles, where UCLA tested the program in 2011.
So today we're going to hand out the predictive policing maps.
Officers receive maps showing the areas of predicted activity for the next shift. Red boxes on the map highlight the hot spots, areas measuring 500 feet by 500 feet, that will require extra patrols.
So the officers know that's the highest probability area where they should be looking for a crime to be committed. And we ask them to get in there and disrupt the crime from occurring or deny the criminal the opportunity to commit the crime.
That's just what happened in 2011 in Santa Cruz, California, where officers were patrolling a hotspot, putting them in the right place at the right time to stop an assault.
We came here, did extra patrols, and we were able to stop a crime in progress before it got worse.
We are helping police fight crime by giving them the best state-of-the-art mathematical models and algorithms to take the data from yesterday and today and figure out what's going to happen tomorrow in the field.
With mathematics and social sciences, police have a new weapon in their arsenal, helping not only to protect and serve, but also to predict a crime before it happens.
Okay, that was fun. That was. I have to thank also the NSF for sponsoring that video. And so now we go back to what happens really on the ground. So you may wonder, how did we get to that point? So let me describe a little bit. You may wonder, you know, do they just suddenly, come up with this idea and suddenly they're stopping crimes in progress? No, the answer is no. Actually, it starts with a lot of basic research. And so our Math of Crime project, as of today, has involved quite a lot of people. Myself and Jeff Brantingham at UCLA are the two people who've sort of spearheaded this, but we've involved several other faculty at UCLA. Lincoln Chase, who's a statistical physicist, Stan Osher, who is an expert in compressive sensing, Rick Schoenberg, who's an expert in point process models, and also George Tita, who's a criminologist at UC Irvine. So lots of different intellects and ideas are going into this field. And we've worked on many, many different types of problems with different classes of models. So we've had one major success in terms of, developing a commercial application, but we actually work on many different topics. And our hope is that someday a lot of the other things that we're doing might also have some direct benefit to society. In terms of human resource development, we've had quite a lot of young people involved in this work, many postdocs. A lot of these folks are now in tenure-track jobs. George Moeller deserves a lot of credit. He's actually the one who kind of started this whole PredPol idea. It started when he was at UCLA with the idea of taking patterns of activity that have already been studied in things like earthquakes and aftershocks, you heard that in the video, and applying those ideas to repeat behavior in criminal activity. So that was George who started that. He was during the time when he was a postdoc, almost a fresh PhD. And we've had many more people involved in this research. I'm going to talk about various people. Also lots of graduate students, PhD students who are now, number of them in tenure-track jobs or working in industry. I have a few names of undergraduates here, but actually, overall, we've had on the order of 50 or more undergraduates involved in this research during the past 8 years. So one of the ways we get so many undergraduates, and by the way, there are many, many good problems for undergraduates because it's very new. So one of the ways we get so many undergraduates involved is we have a summer REU program at UCLA in computational and applied math. The students work in teams of four on different topics. So some of the topics are on lots of different problems, fluid dynamics, plant ecology, lots of different topics, but we often have one on crime. So, and there's a sort of partner program at our Institute for Pure and Applied Math that also typically has one of these crime projects as well. So in any given summer, we can have 8 undergraduates working on this general class of problems. So now let's talk about how you get involved with crime research. Well, you can't do it in a vacuum. You actually need to talk to people who are working directly with criminals and who care about the problems. And these are typically law enforcement agencies. So our primary agency that we work with, not surprisingly, is the LAPD, Los Angeles Police Department. And we've been very fortunate to have the connection with Sean Malinowski. You saw him in the video. He's a real person and he has a PhD. And this is very important if you want to actually do basic research working on crime problems, because it helps if the person who you're getting information from and collecting problems from understands what it is to do basic research. And, when we started working with them, we told Sean straight out, we said, look, we want to do basic research here. We may work for 10 years and have nothing that you can use. We're not asking for money from you. We're not asking for resources. We are asking for data, and we're asking for you to talk to us. And we hope that something we develop could eventually be useful for you, but that's not our primary goal initially. We wanted to do good science initially. So he was willing to work with us in that context, and that was very good for us. We would not have been able to do this.
Is it common for large police departments to have a PhD? To have somebody with a PhD?
I don't know. But they have one.
Maybe in police studies.
Yeah. Like yeah. I mean, he's a real, you know, I mean, he does real police work, you know. I mean, yeah, yeah. He's a real guy. He wears a uniform, you know. Yeah. Yeah, so we've also worked with Santa Cruz and Long Beach as well. In fact, Santa Cruz was the impetus for trying to push some of our stuff into the field, because they actually called George Mueller up and said, we've heard, you know, your stuff has been... So one thing I have to say is that when you write research papers that are interesting about crime problems, people notice, much more so than when you write about some of the other things I've worked on, like fluid dynamics. You know, suddenly your work is showing up in the New York Times and Discover Magazine, right, because it's cool, right? So they heard about this and actually contacted George and said, hey, we want to try your stuff. And George is like, you want to try my stuff? You know, okay. So he actually gave them some software to play with, and that was the story about Santa Cruz having a 20% reduction in crime in the first month. They went from basically nothing to using our stuff. And pretty soon after that, Los Angeles followed suit. But LAPD has been using data-intensive ideas for quite a long time. So it was a much more difficult hurdle for us to give them something useful, because they already had a lot of useful things. And we're not a software shop. You know, we're scientists trying to publish papers, right? So, okay, so this is important to have this connection. And so now what I want to do is I want to go back in time and start going over some of the different classes of models we work with, just to give you an idea, flavor, for how mathematics can be used to study problems in crime. And there are going to be two classes of models. I call them bottom-up and top-down. And the bottom-up models are models that are basically agent-based models. The idea is you're trying to model in a simple way sort of aggregate human behavior. How are people going to make decisions, how they're going to move through space, and how that space is going to change because of their actions. And then we'd like to think about these problems as occurring in a large space with many, many people. And hopefully there's some kind of aggregate dynamics that, you know, sort of self-organizes. And can we use our mathematics to understand that? So that was our initial approach to working on these problems. We have several papers in that vein, and I'm going to start with one example with residential burglary. The other class of models that we worked with are the ones where that earthquake stuff belongs. I call them top-down, but they're basically data-driven models. So you look at the field data. You look at what is being observed. You don't know the details of what's leading to those observations, but if you can characterize the patterns in the data, that may be all that you need to know to be able to make predictions for the future. And so that's the top-down approach, and that's the stuff that's actually being used in the field, but I think all of these are interesting examples. So I'm gonna start with kind of a cute little example. This is our very first paper that we wrote on crime, and it's associated with a model for residential burglary. So imagine that you have a city with houses on a grid, and each house has some likelihood of being broken into. We call this attractiveness, A. And that A value has two terms. There's a blue part and a red part, and the blue part does not change in time. It's got to do with sort of intrinsic features of the neighborhood, like the housing density, which typically doesn't change much over time, things like that. The red value may change on a fairly short time scale of a week or two, okay? So, and that red value is going to change as activity happens in the neighborhood. So now we're going to introduce the criminals. So I have two criminals, and I have more than that, but in this little cartoon I have two. And each criminal is going to do two things. They're going to move with a biased random walk throughout the space. They're going to make a decision about which direction they're going to move based on how attractive the house that they're at is and how attractive the nearby houses are. So let's look at one iteration of that process. So this criminal just made a decision to move from a lower attractive house to a more attractive house. This criminal is sitting at a very attractive house. So this one did not move. Okay, so that's one iteration of the motion part of the problem. And then they make a decision as to whether they're going to break into that house that they're looking at. And that depends, of course, this is all probabilistic. So with some probability, each of these criminals breaks into a house, and the probability is a function of how attractive the house is. So this one is very attractive, high probability of having an incident, and indeed the burglar breaks into this house. This one decides, no, I'm not going to break into this house right now. This one breaks into the house, takes the loot, and goes home, so that burglar is gone. And this one is still here. And now another, so a very interesting thing happens, because an event has just happened at this house. So what does that event do? It actually causes the attractiveness of this house to go up. But also, the nearby houses also increase their attractiveness. And you might say, this sounds like an awfully contrived model. I mean, how do you know this happens in real life? Well, we have data, a lot of it, as I said, from the police, and we have data about when events occur at different houses and what happens to the nearby houses. So we can actually measure quantitatively these rates. We can look at the data, and on average, we can estimate all of these rates, how far out this spread occurs, how quickly these rates increase. And then, you know, so you might wonder, why on earth would this house become more attractive after an event? Well, there are many reasons why, and we don't want to go into that level of granularity in the model. But I can name, just off the top of my head, I can name some reasons. So one is that the criminal was not caught. And they took the TV, but they didn't have room to take the CD player, but they saw it. And they said, I'm going to go back and get that thing. Right? So that's number one. Number two is maybe they broke a window to get in, and that broken window is visible from the street. And another criminal wanders by and sees the broken window and says, oh, that house is vulnerable. I'm going to go in and check that thing out. The criminal that broke into this house may have noticed that the next door house is almost identical to this one, and so they have an idea what the floor plan looks like and maybe what the windows look like. So they feel more comfortable coming back and breaking into the nearby houses. So those are just examples of reasons. There are many studies out there. People have gone and interviewed criminals who've been caught and asked them how do they make their choices. So we have a lot of anecdotal information. But at the end of the day, to model this properly, we just need to look at the data and see what's going on. Okay, so on a longer time scale, something else happens, which is that all of these red values decay. Now, why would that happen? Well, if my house was just broken into, I'm more likely to call up ADT and get an alarm system installed after that break-in. It might not happen tomorrow, but it could happen within the next month. I'm likely to repair the window. If I discover that my neighbor's been broken into, I might still call up and get the alarm system. Or, you know, I've been thinking about going down to the shelter and adopting that big dog, and suddenly the incentive is higher to get the big dog. I have done this in my life. I'm not saying that it was correlated, but I did get a dog after a break-in at one point. So I saw a hand. Is that a stretch? That's a stretch. Okay, very good. All right, so that's allowed. All right, so this is our very simple model. You've seen all the parts of the model, and we just repeat this. And you can put this on a computer, and you can run it in a big simulation with a lot of criminals over a large geographic area and pretend that it's Los Angeles. Of course, Los Angeles is not a uniform grid, but nevertheless, you get the idea. So something very interesting happens with this model. Depending on the parameters, we have one of two things. Either the crime sort of, this is, by the way, I'm showing you the attractiveness, but that gives us an idea of the crime rate. So, and this is space in 2D. So in this example, what you see is that we have random fluctuations about some mean, but there are no hot spots forming in this particular simulation. However, in this simulation here, we see coherent structures of high crime areas are self-organizing on their own. They're not there at the beginning, but very quickly they self-organize, and they remain relatively stable with some kind of long length scale. Likewise, in this simulation, we get these hotspots as well, but they tend to come and go in different regions. But they're very similar in structure otherwise to these. Okay? Yeah. Yep.
And a burglary happens and it goes up to 2 plus
12. Yeah. No. Well, so it's not going to get lower than the base blue value. That's the model that we're using. It could because there is this decay rate over time. So it could. We're just starting with some initialization that's not uniform. So yes, the answer is yes. Yeah. And of course we do have to start with some kind of random initialization to make something interesting happen. But you can see from a random initialization that we get these rather large coherent structures that are not random at all. Okay? So how on earth can we develop a theory to explain this? So you might think, okay, you just do a bunch of simulations and you start seeing that for some parameters you get this, and other parameters you get one of these, and there seems to be some nice sharp boundary in parameter space, and there is. And it turns out there's a formula. So it turns out we can write down an analytical formula for the parameters in the model to tell us whether we're going to see spots or no spots. So let me tell you, I'm not going to give you the formula, but I'm going to tell you how to derive it. Okay? And so for the non-mathematicians in the audience, don't go completely to sleep on me, because I'm going to try to make this quick. So this is one of the few slides in my talk with equations, but I felt for the mathematicians I owed you equations. So here they are. Okay, so these are partial differential equations, and this is a mean field theory. So we're now living in the land of statistical physics, and we're developing a mean field theory for this stochastic model on the grid. And so what I get are coupled partial differential equations for the time evolution of the attractiveness value in space and the Bergler concentration, which I'm going to call rho, the density of Berglers. Okay? And so let's kind of parse these equations so I can assign sort of mechanistic behaviors to each of the terms. So at the level of the attractiveness, the fact that when I have an increase in crime, that increase leads to higher attractiveness, not only at my house, but at nearby houses, creates a diffusion effect, and that's modeled by this diffusion term. The fact that people repair damage done to their house and thereby decrease attractiveness gives us a decay rate, and this omega we can actually measure in the data, and the diffusion we can also measure in the data. This growth term is basically the increase in attractiveness right after an initial crime. So I can quantify all of these things, and so this equation essentially I can get all of the constants right out of the field data. So where we have trouble with the model in terms of connecting the real world to the math is in the model for the burglars. Why? Because I am not putting radio collars on the burglars and tracking where they go. Okay, I'm going to show you an example from ecology in an upcoming slide where one can do that. But those are animals in the wild. Okay, and the burglars, maybe we think they're animals in the wild, but there are a lot of reasons why we can't do that, right? Right? So without the radio collars, we have to make something up based on sort of natural movement of people, right? So we assume that these are crimes of opportunity, that they're basically going about their lives, and, oh, look over there, a house to break into. Let's go do that, right? So they're not necessarily casing something out for weeks on end and making a big production about it. They're just kind of, they're walking to the coffee shop and, oh, look at that. I see a box sitting out on the front lawn for a new TV. You know, maybe there's a TV in that house, right? That kind of thing. Crimes of opportunity. So, very simple model. The random walk turns into a diffusion process for the density. The bias towards houses that are more attractive turns into an advection term here. And then the criminals go home when they get something, so that's the minus rho A. That's the rate at which they commit crimes. And then they wake up, they come back into the environment with some rate gamma. So that's a very simple model. And this is basically fiction, and this is basically what we can get out of the data. But anyway, once we have our model and we have a few parameters, we can then do something that PDE people all know how to do. And even people who aren't in PDEs often know how to do this. A lot of engineers know how to do this, which is linear stability analysis. So it's a very simple technique, mathematical technique. You find an exact solution to the equations that's constant in space and doesn't change and happens to solve the equations, a very simple example. And then what you do is you add a perturbation to that, you plug it in to the equations, and you linearize. And so I'm waving my hands, there's some magic that happens there. Right? And then you know, when you do that, and then you get an equation for whether that state is stable or not. Okay, and you can almost read it off from the math. And so it turns out if you do that exercise, it turns out that you actually get a formula for whether or not this uniform state is stable. And you can look at the formula, and it agrees exactly with the empirical transition from this kind of behavior to the behavior with the spots. So that's an example of some well-known but not easy mathematics giving us a theory for this. Okay, but it turns out you can do more than just create a theory for stability of the uniform state. You can actually understand the dynamics of these spots, because in reality, you're going to have these, and the police are going to want to go and suppress them. And they're going to want to know if they show up in an area of high crime and have more of a police presence, are they going to suppress the crime, or are they going to merely send the criminals next door to commit their crimes in another location? Okay, so now what I want to do is show you some empirical results, but also I'll hint at some theory. We did the theory, but I'm not going to write the equations down this time, where we can actually predict that issue, right? So we're going to do something that goes far beyond linear stability analysis. So the first thing I wanted to mention is that once you have coupled partial differential equations, simulating the hotspots becomes a much easier tool. You don't have to run a computer simulation where every single burglar is kept track of in the simulation. Suddenly, you can solve a coupled set of partial differential equations using well-known methods from numerical analysis, and it's very fast. On a computer, we don't get the fluctuations because these are deterministic models, but we do get the hotspots. Okay, so now I'm going to go to how do we understand the suppression problem? And to do that, we have to use some mathematical theory involving nonlinear analysis. So what I have here is an example of a simulation. This is the agent-based model. This is the one with all the criminals in the simulation, so a very complicated computation, and you see the hotspots forming, and you may wonder, what is this? This is the location of where we're going to put the police. So this is an example of how LAPD used to deal with crime hotspots. They call it cops on the dots. It's a very sophisticated method. You send the police to the regions where you have high crime, okay? So in this particular simulation, the cops are going to the dots, and the crimes are moving to other locations. So this is an example. In our simple model, it's an example of police suppression leading to displacement of crime rather than suppression of crime. Okay, so our simple model shows this. And you might say, okay, well, maybe that's all the model is going to show, and that's not true. It turns out that I can find, with a slightly different set of parameters, I can find an example where we have a crime hotspot, and the police are going to come in, and here they come, and here, there they are. So the police come in and they suppress the hotspot. You notice there's no displacement here. Okay? And to really convince ourselves there's no displacement, the police are going to go away and there's still no hotspot. So that's a bit strange because I just told you it's the exact same model with slightly different parameters. And you may wonder what's going on. So it turns out we have a theory for this, and we can predict this too, but it involves using ideas from mathematics called bifurcation theory. And it's really the nonlinearity in the system that gives us this bifurcation. It turns out that uniform flat state, when it becomes unstable, we can have either a supercritical or subcritical bifurcation. And in one situation, we get this kind of behavior where you can suppress the crime. That's the subcritical case. And in the supercritical case, we cannot. We only get displacement. And there's a lot of technical math behind this. So for those of you who know nonlinear analysis, you probably have an idea of what I'm talking about. For those of you who don't, maybe you're thinking, I should learn that stuff, right? Because it allows us to really understand quantitatively these very complex behaviors that can arise from seemingly simple self-organized systems. Okay, so I'm going to talk about another example that's a bit more... So not so technical, this part of the talk, but But it sort of brings home the issue of how do we work with data and what's hard about crime compared to problems in ecology. So I had a student, Laura Smith, from a few years ago who wanted to study the formation of gang territories in regions where you have a number of street gangs. And she felt that there ought to be a connection to models from the ecology literature. So she was quite interested in a paper that came out in 2006 on coyote territories in Yellowstone. And I think this is a lovely paper because it shows how one can couple the mechanistic modeling of the animal populations with the real data that's collected in the field. And this is one of the challenges that we want to try to overcome with the crime data. So about 6 years later, Laura published this very nice paper in the Applied Math Literature that basically adapts this model to the street gang problem. So it's a very simple idea. We're going to have sort of a parallel between the two problems. So instead of looking at the behavior of coyotes, we're going to look at the behavior of street gang members. But the coyotes typically live in packs. So there's a small number of coyote packs in Yellowstone, and these packs are going to be the analog of the actual street gangs in Los Angeles. And these packs in Yellowstone have very well-defined territories. So each pack tends to live in a certain location, like the street gang members do in Los Angeles. And something very important for both of these examples is that the people or the animals involved have a way of defining where their territory is. They have a way of marking their territory, right? So that's got to be part of the model. So the coyotes, I don't know coyotes very well, but I have a male dog, which is a related animal, and he marks his territory all the time when I take him out to walk. So you all know how they do this, right? Okay. So street gang members don't use the same mechanism. They use a visual cue instead of an odor cue. So they get cans of spray paint, and they have colors that are associated with their gang, and they have symbols. So they basically go into the city and they mark up their territory with their tags, with the symbols associated with their gang. But they play a very similar role, we believe, to the scent markings that coyotes use. That was at least the premise that we were interested in. So this is one example of what you can do with the ecological problem. So we're looking at a picture of Yellowstone. This is a map of Yellowstone. So it's a contour plot of the elevation with some information superimposed on it. So there are two pieces of information that are superimposed. One is the actual field data of the location of coyotes in each of the five packs that have been identified. So we're coloring the packs with different colors, and the dots correspond to the tracking, the location of the tracking device that was put on the animal as it moves around in its particular location. And what you see is in the field data that they're really very localized to their area of Yellowstone. Now, what we did, or what the authors of this paper did, was they came up with a partial differential equation model, a mechanistic model for the movement patterns that took into account how they would respond to scent markings and where they would put their scent markings. So they have to model both the densities of the animals in each of the packs, but they also have to look at the concentration of the scent markings as well. And you can see that that this model generates fairly sharp boundaries. So the colored lines correspond to density contours of the mathematical model for the coyote population. And you can see that this model creates fairly sharp boundaries between the different packs, and the population density predicted by the model agrees fairly well with the at least the observations of the field data. So this is image, in a sense, is what Laura was quite excited about and said, we should really try this to model the street gangs in Los Angeles. So we looked at Laura looked at a specific area of Los Angeles called the Hollenbeck Division. And this is a map of Hollenbeck. And in this particular example, we have 30 street gangs that each have a color. And these are the sort of the known set spaces of those street gangs. Now, the terrain elevation is not so interesting in Hollenbeck compared to Yellowstone, but there are very natural and important geographic boundaries for movement. And those boundaries are the freeways. So you can see the 10 freeway, the 5 freeway. There's a bunch of freeways that go through Hollenbeck. And there's also another boundary, which is the LA River, which is the blue line on the edge. If you've never been to Los Angeles and seen the LA River, you've probably seen it in movies. It's this big concrete river. And you may wonder, why do they have a concrete river? Well, it serves a very important drainage purpose for water runoff in the city of Los Angeles. So it's important to actually have that, even though it looks horrible. Although people canoe on it, I hear. So, yeah. So anyway, the LA River and the freeways. So one can limit the movement patterns of the street gang members in the simulation based on things like the local geography, where the freeways are. You know, if there aren't too many roads going underneath the freeway, then you limit movement patterns across that freeway, for example. And so what Laura did was she assumed a few known things. So she assumed that the centers of each of the set spaces were given, and she assumed that the size of the street gang was also known. But the actual boundaries that are created were not known. She wanted to figure that out by simulating an analogous model. So this is a challenging thing to do. When you solve this problem, you actually have to solve five coupled PDEs for the population densities of each of the packs, and another five equations for the scent marking concentrations of each of the packs. So 10 coupled PDEs for this. In this case, we have 30 street gangs. So you can do the math. 30 times 2 is 60. 60 coupled partial differential equations, which you run on a cluster. You don't run that on a desktop machine. So to give you an idea of the complexity, you know, this is why this was a math PhD thesis problem rather than something we give to our undergraduates, right? So she did this, and she generated population densities for the street gangs, and she generated concentrations for where the gang tags ought to occur. And unfortunately, and this now connects to the issue of collecting data and comparing models to data, because we are working with the police, and the police do not clean up graffiti. The city of Los Angeles cleans up graffiti, and therefore the police do not have data on where the graffiti is located. It seems kind of silly, but they don't have it. So we didn't have that data. But we did have data on where violence happened. So we have a very good understanding of where, at least the events that are reported, but that's probably already a good data set to work with. So this was the closest we could get to comparing this model with field data, and it was comparing where the gang tag locations occur in correspondence to where the violence is occurring in the same area of Hollenbeck. And we had to do something very crude. Laura had to do something very crude, but it looks like something that's sort of interesting, I think. So what she did was she started thresholding in her simulation, the results of her simulation, thresholding the gang tag concentration to see what areas of the city had a lot of gang tags. So depending on where you put this cutoff threshold, you get different amounts of the city with a lot of the gang tags. So for example, let's take this line here. We can identify an area of the city that has, you know, sort of a disproportionate amount of gang tags, but it's only about 22% of the Hollenbeck region, yet that area happens to have 71% of all the violent crime. And the idea was maybe there's some correlation between the boundaries of these street gangs and where the violent crimes might be likely to occur. So it's a very weak comparison to data because we don't have the data that we might like to have for strong comparison. But it gives you an idea of, you know, what you can do with this kind of data, and also hopefully this kind of study. Our hope is that it might lead to an incentive to go back and try to collect data that would be of interest. We're not going to put radio collars on the criminals. You know that's not going to happen, right? I mean, I don't think we want to live in a world where that would happen. But we can go out and take pictures of the graffiti, right? That's public information, right? It's on the street. So we should be able to collect that data. So that's been sort of a priority on our minds, is to find out a way to get that information. Okay, so now I'm gonna. So now I want to go and talk about the top-down modeling, and this is the kinds of ideas that led to our software pred poem. And I want to do an example that involves. I want to do a little bit of an audience participation example, and so we're going to start with the special case of gang crimes, and we're going to look at the temporal statistics of gang crimes. Where the gang crimes are occurring in one area of the city where we have a sort of well-known rivalry network. So this is, again, Hollenbeck, and this is, as of 2003, what the police believed was the correct rivalry network for the 29 gangs at that time in this part of the city. So this is a hard problem. Just by looking at this, you can see it's a hard problem because you've got a small area of Los Angeles where there are 29 known street gangs, and each gang has, you know, I mean, at least 100 members. Let's kind of pick a number out of thin air, but that could be 1,000 members. You know, we're not talking about a gang of two, right? So some of them fight with each other. Hazard and Clover are enemies, but Hazard and Rose Hill are not enemies, right? That doesn't mean they're friends. Right? You can't take the complement graph and say that's the friendship network, because that's not the case. It just means that they're not actively fighting each other. So this is a rivalry network. Okay, so now this is the magic model. This is our Hawks process model. So we're looking for a model that gives us a way of characterizing the likelihood of events to happen based on prior events. So we have some intent. So this, in the case of the rivalry, we have an intensity that has some background rate, like a Poisson arrival process. And then there is a self-excitation that happens once you have an event. So this is the TI is the time of the most recent event. And you can see that there's a decay from that time. There's an excitation strength, and then there's a time scale associated with that. So this is the time, right, I just said that. This is the retaliation strength and the duration of the retaliation. So this is our model. And it may seem overly simplistic, so I want to work through a quick thought experiment with the audience to see why maybe it's not a terrible thing to do. So I need two gangs. So I need to somehow break you into two different groups. So we could do students and faculty. Or we could do mathematicians and scientists. Any preferences there? How many students do we have? We have a few. Do you guys want to do students versus faculty? Yeah, I see the faculty nodding their head. The students are like hiding. Or do you guys want to do math versus non-math? Students versus faculty. Okay, I need a leader of the students. Okay, what's your name? Andy. Okay, Andy is the gang leader of the student gang. And I need a leader of the faculty gang. And Paul's wearing a tie. So I think Paul's the leader of the faculty gang. So we have the sweater versus the tie. Okay, so. All right, so let's see. How are we going to set this up? So, okay, the students are going to initiate this. Do you guys have a faculty lounge or something where you hang out together?
We used to, but we never used it, so it.
Okay, I need one for the story. So, okay, let's suppose there's one. Okay, Shoyer room. Okay, all right. And so, okay, so the students are you guys in dorms here? All right. So Andy is hanging out with the students in the dorm, and they're getting kind of annoyed with the faculty because they're springing pop quizzes on them at the last minute, right? And they hang out in the Shoyer room. That's a great place, and the students have a crummy place to hang out. So the students get together one night with their can of spray paint, and they go over to the faculty hangout place, and they spray paint "Students Rule," okay, on your location, right? So you guys, you know, show up at your usual hour in the morning with your coffee, and you go to your place, and you see this, and you're like, oh my God, look what the students did. So now, Paul, you need to make a choice. So you have two choices. So one choice is that you decide you're going to be above all of this, and you're going to turn the other cheek and not respond to this and set a good example. Okay, the other choice is you're going to get back at them. You're going to sneak over to their dorm and play a trick on them late at night. So you get to pick which one. And there's no right answer. You're above it all. Okay, Paul's above it all. The tie says I'm wearing a tie. we're above this. So Andy, the next night, you guys are in your dorm, and you're thinking, they didn't do anything. They didn't do anything. So what do you do? Yes, you do. Yes, you do. Okay, so there you go. So that was the experiment. Okay, that was the experiment. So you may wonder, should we have a rate that somehow involves gang A picking on gang B, and then you have to retaliate B back to A? And the answer is it doesn't necessarily matter. Okay, what matters is that you have some event that happens and it triggers another event. It could be a retaliation back, or it could be just a repeat attack in the same direction from this, you know, the original attacker back to the original attackee. So we decided that we wanted to work with the simplest possible model that would make sense for gang crimes in LA. And it turns out we have both kinds of scenarios in Hollenbeck. We have examples where one gang repeatedly picks on another one. Maybe after a long time, that gang eventually goes away. But on the time scale that we're interested in here, not typically. Typically, you'll just have these repeat events, okay? So that's the idea. And what you can do is you can take actual field data and you can do some statistical analysis on it and fit those three parameters in the Hox process model. So here's an example of real crime data from Los Angeles over a three-year period. We had a group of undergraduates look at this data and compute these three parameters, mu, k-naught, and omega, for this data. And then what you get is you can then solve for lambda as a function of time, and you get a corresponding time series here of the crime rate based on these actual events. So this is real data. But what's beautiful about this problem is that once you can do this, you now have these three parameters, which allows you to simulate crimes, right? So you can also generate fake data. So this is fake data that has, in some sense, the same kind of temporal structure as the real crime data. So I'm going to get to this in a second. But then what you can do is you can then go and analyze all of these different rivalries. And so the students did this. This was a big project for them. And compute these three parameters for lots and lots of different rivalries in Los Angeles. And then you can ask yourself, well, is this a good model? So if you're going to do statistical analysis of a model, you have to compare it to another model. And so the obvious model to compare this to is the Poisson arrival process, a single parameter model. And the criteria that they used was the Akaki information criteria, which penalizes against the number of parameters. So three parameters is worse than one parameter. But even so, what we discover is that with many of these pairs of rivals, that three-parameter Hox process is a better fit than the Poisson process. So this tells us, at least with some, gives us some idea that maybe these really are self-exciting behaviors. And common sense tells us they probably are self-exciting, right? Because one gang attacks another gang, and then, of course, they're going to respond. And these are typically not crimes involving things like graffiti. We're talking about shots fired, sometimes even the level of homicide. So these are big crimes. This is not a fun example. This is not a good example. So there's a lot of interest to try to understand this and for the police to be able to do something with the mathematics. So this led to the PhD thesis work of Alexei Stamakin, who's pictured here. Alexei had the challenging problem of helping LAPD solve unsolved crimes. So that was the problem that was posed to us. And they said, you know, in a given year, we may have solved something like two-thirds of the crimes in Hollenbeck that we think are gang crimes, but there's the other one-third, which could be several hundred crimes, for which we do not know who committed the crime. We don't even know which gang committed the crime, because there are 30. And, you know. So they said, if you can narrow it down to three gangs, then we think we have a better chance of solving the crime. But with just 30, it's hard to pick. So we don't know who to look at. So that was the challenge that was given to us. They said, given a set of crimes that are unsolved and another set that are solved, can you figure out with some probability what gang was likely to have committed the crime, just based on the mathematics of the pattern? You know, they don't expect us to go into the field and interview criminals. That's not what we know how to do. We're not trained to do that, but we are trained to do this. So this is our cartoon of the problem that Alexei solved. And what you see is that we have what am I showing here? These are timelines. So they're synchronized timelines corresponding to each of the different rivalry pairs. Okay, so I only drew three because I have to visualize it. I can only show so many. And these bars here correspond to events where we know when the event occurred, but we don't know who committed the crime. So these are the unsolved crimes. And the dark circles are the solved crimes. Okay, so here's the challenge. The challenge is every time we have an unsolved crime, we have to pick one of these timelines and put it on that timeline. We have to make that assignment. And we have to do that not just once, but for many unsolved crimes in a way that best fits this Hawkes process model, having generated the data. So for each of these timelines, in the background is a Hawkes process. So that is the challenge. It's a combinatorially complex problem. And you don't want to try making random guesses and testing all the random guesses. Okay, because you can't do that with two crimes, three crimes, yes. With 100 or 200 crimes, no. Okay, so what do we do? So we're mathematicians, and I work at UCLA, which is a famous place for variational methods for inverse problems. And this is an inverse problem that we can solve using a variational method. So what does that mean? Mathematically, that means we construct an energy functional that we're going to either maximize or minimize that is somehow telling us something about the problem. So the way we turn this into a variational problem is rather than looking at this as an assignment problem, we look at this as a problem where we're going to assign a weight vector to each of these possible timelines. And so rather than picking one, we're going to put weights on each of them and try to find the best choice of weights. So we relax the problem from a combinatorial problem to one that now lives in continuum. So that's what we do. And so the weight vectors are these MIs. And this is the functional that we want to optimize, but we have to have constraints. So a natural set of constraints you might think is, well, it's a probability vector, so you sum to 1. And we actually did not do that. We took the sum of the squares equals 1. Which is an L2 constraint, and it turned out for a variety of reasons that was mathematically a better choice for this problem. So there's our sum of squares equals 1, and also these entries have to be non-negative. The weights cannot be negative, they have to be non-negative. So this was the math problem that Alexei used as his model, and then to solve this optimization problem is actually a fairly straightforward thing to do if one has appropriate mathematical training. One does a gradient descent, and it works quite well, and you know, you can compare it with exact solutions when you can find them. So this is what he did, and here are the results. So these are so he ran a lot of simulations to show what you get. Now this is where having simulated data is very important. Why? Because the actual field data of unsolved crimes, they're unsolved crimes. We don't know the ground truth. Right? If they're unsolved, we have no idea. So we can't use that data to bench our code. But what we can do is we can take our simulator for the Hawkes process and generate a bunch of simulated crimes using this model, and then pretend that we don't know some fraction of them, and then try to figure out which pair of gangs committed those crimes. So if we do that, and we use kind of parameters that are similar to the field data, we discover that we can get the top three gangs right about 80% of the time, which is good because it turns out for the same kind of data, if you just guess based on the rivalry network, it's about a 50% chance of getting the top three. And this was the metric that LAPD gave to us, top three. So you may wonder, are they using this today? They're not, because we think we can do even better than this. This particular paper was the first of its kind, looking only at temporal statistics, but we have a lot more information. We have the spatial information about where the crimes occur, for example. We have a lot of other data, and we felt that if we're going to give something to LAPD to use in the field, it should use more than just this. So, you know, I have to finish, right, because we're kind of running over, I think. Right? Yeah. Getting there? Okay. So, actually, according to my clock, I've been talking for, the computer says 40, but that doesn't include the video. So probably 52, 53 minutes. Okay. So since I don't have a lot more time, what I thought I'd do is just kind of touch on some of the other things that we're working on and the kind of math that we're using. So we're using graph theory to understand a data set involving what are called field interview cards. So This is one of the interesting data sets that we do have with a lot of information, although it's very sparse. So this is, again, in the gang neighborhood. Because LA has gang injunction neighborhoods, these are areas where the police can go in and they can see a group of people together on the street and they can stop them and they can ask their names, they can ask to see their driver's licenses, they can record this information, and they can say, you know, where this is and when it is. So that's just so they're not committing a crime, they're just together in a group, and they can record information about them, and all of this ends up in a big database, which we have access to. So we can take this data, and we can look and see, what does the data tell us about who is talking to whom, and where are they doing these things in this neighborhood. So for example, we took a year's worth of field interview cards, and we took the spatial locations and the social network that came out of the cards. You know, this person and this person were seen together, therefore they must be connected in a social network. And you take all of this information and you can run something called spectral clustering, which is a graph-based algorithm, to find sort of natural groupings in the data. And then you can compare it to ground truth. So we actually have ground truth for a lot of the people that were observed together because they're actually gang members. So the colors here correspond to the gang affiliation of the people that we observed. These are, in this case, 31 gangs. And this is the geographic location of the natural groupings that arose from the raw data. And so what you can see here is, for example, this is a pie chart that says, here's one group that we see in the data set. And that one group is composed almost entirely of the white gang. So that's very close to what we know from ground truth in terms of the gang affiliation. But we also see up here that there are natural groupings in the data that have predominantly, each of them, this dark green gang, but also a few people from some of the other colored gangs. Right? So what the data is telling us something that goes quite contrary to what we thought of as kind of, you know, anecdotally how things happen in Hollenbeck, which is that members of different gangs don't associate with each other, but in fact it seems that they do in sort of interesting patterns too. Also, you know, geographically, the 10 freeway kind of slices through here, and you sort of see that geography in the data. And this was just sort of the first thing we did with this. Somehow it got some attention. We actually published this in the SIAM Journal of Applied Math, and they had a nice press release, and we got some press for this. But it's a very simple thing to do and kind of touches the tip of the iceberg of what you can do with data. I'm going to skip this slide for the interest of time. I'm going to go on to a slide that I think a lot of the students will connect with. Also, this is from our summer RU in 2014. Just a few months ago, the students did this. So this is Twitter data. So the police are quite interested in social media because they think it has information that's relevant to them. And so we have been interested in trying to develop algorithms to sort through the huge volume of social media that's now publicly available on the internet. So we had our students look at a large collection of tweets, Twitter data from Los Angeles. So this is just text information, but it also has a geographic location. So each tweet will typically also have some geocoded information about where the tweet came from. And of course the text. So what the students did was they worked on a method called non-negative matrix factorization, where you take, so I'll just say that each tweet you can represent as a vector of how frequently the words in the tweet appear in that tweet, right? So you're ignoring the order of the words and you're just looking at how often to use this particular word. So you get this very, very, very big matrix that has words on one axis and then the tweets on the other axis. So it's huge. And the idea is to factor it into the product of two matrices, one of which is tweet by topic and topic by word. And of course, the goal is to figure out the topics, right? We don't know the topics. That's the challenge, is to figure out. And of course, they have to be non-negative. You can't have negative words or topics. So that's the idea. And there's a lot of detail that goes into that. But anyway, once you do non-negative matrix factorization and you get some topics, you can then ask, well, what are the topics? Do they really correspond to topics, or are they just kind of random? So here's an example of, so they had several hundred topics out of all these tweets. And this is topic number 158. We like this example because when you pull out all the tweets associated with topic 158, you discover that they are spatially concentrated in a very narrow area of Los Angeles. And then when you look at where they are, you discover they're at the LA Metro. We actually have a metro in Los Angeles. You might not know that, but we do have public transportation. And so these are at the metro stations, and they're talking about graffiti and things like that at the metro stations. So these really were tweets that had some connection to each other. And then once you do this, you can go crazy with it and look at the temporal statistics. So one of the things the students did was they looked at whether the tweets were self-exciting. So can you model these as a Hox process, for example? And you can, and it turns out they are typically self-exciting, and you can do Akaki information criteria, and there it is. And you discover that the self-exciting model, which is the blue one, the dark blue one, is a better fit than a Poisson model to Twitter data. No surprise, because typically when somebody tweets, another person will respond to that. So I think I've kind of run to the edge of my time, but I wanted to give you an idea of the broad spectrum of problems that we're working on at UCLA related to crime and the large variety of mathematics that we're using, statistical physics, PDE, graph theory, stochastic processes, lots of different mathematics, and it all has to kind of come together in an interesting way. And I think this is very exciting as a research mathematician to be working on an important problem in society and one that allows us to bring out a lot of interesting mathematics. So I'm going to stop there and thank lots of people who gave us lots of money and lots of data. And thank you all for coming.